Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to Whispers from the Heart, a mini-series of conversations about our relationships with the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Steph Watts, and we've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm sharing a house with them.
So join us on our quest into the glorious world of Ghibli.
So, this mini-series has taken us kind of all over the world so far. We've been to Kilkenny with Cartoon Saloon. We've been to LA with Domishi and Pixar. Returning to Japan and Ghibli for this episode. Michael, who are we talking to?
So today, yeah, this is going back to basics. This is one for the hardcore Ghibli nerds. This is Steve Alpert. We've mentioned Steve on the podcast a couple of times. He wrote a book, which has now been released in English, called Sharing a House with the Never-Ending Man. He was very important in the history of Studio Ghibli. He was their first head of international, hired in the mid-late 90s as Ghibli started to expand into international markets. So he was involved in the way that Princess Mononoke was localized for the States. He was there and very much involved in that process. He was, of course, there as well when Spirited Away took off for its Oscar run, its festival runs, absolutely everything. And the book is really fascinating, I will say. Strongly recommend it if you want some good insider chat about Ghibli. And if you've listened this far into the podcast, I think you're interested in the insider chat. Steve really gives us a lot of insight into the characters behind Ghibli as well as the process. Fantastic, like, pen portraits of Miyazaki, a tiny bit of Takahata. But if you are a Toshio Suzuki stan, as I know that we are, there's a lot in here about him, but also a person that we've not really spoken much about, which is the big dog himself, Yasuyoshi Tokuma, who is head of Tokuma Shoten, Ghibli's parent company. And a person we've maybe mentioned once or twice in the history, but Steve worked directly with him, and he seems like, he seemed like an incredible character. And if you have any interest in the differences between Western and Japanese business practices, there's a lot of that in here too. So that's Sharing a House with Never-Ending Man. It's got a great cover, actually, because one of the trivia point about Steve is that he came back after he'd retired from Ghibli in the 2010s to voice Castorp, the mysterious German guy in The Wind Rises, who was then dubbed into English by Werner Herzog when it finally did the English version. So the cover is the character of Castorp looking very mysterious with a cigarette. But yeah, it was so good to talk with Steve about all sorts. This is the second time we've spoken to somebody who has first-hand experience of working with Ghibli. So, of course, we want to speak at great length to get as much out of them as we can. And we're so grateful to Steve for spending time with us.
And in very typical Ghibli fashion, we've got nature involving itself in our very conversation, as Steve did record this conversation outside.
So here is Steve Alpert talking about Ghibli. Steve, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
It's absolutely an honour always to talk with anybody related to Studio Ghibli and its history. But also, you played such an important role during a really important phase in that history of the studio. Could you remind me of exactly what your job title was?
You know, Studio Ghibli wasn't really big on job titles. It's a funny question to begin with. But I was in, charge of... No, really, I mean, you know, Miyazaki-san was called the shocho. So that's a made-up term in Japanese, which means the head of the place. Do you speak Japanese? I don't know. I didn't ask, but...
Not very well, no.
So president is shocho, which is a real term. That was Suzuki-san. Miyazaki-san was shocho. So people in the studio had kind of unusual titles. But my business card would have said senior vice president in charge of international distribution, I guess. And right. they made me a senior vice president because I was basically, aside from Miyazaki-san and Suzuki-san, I was by far the oldest person in the studio. So they thought senior would be good for that.
The dictionary definition of the term senior.
Right.
So, never more apt. But, right.
But my job was to get distribution for Ghibli's films outside of Japan. And at that time, most, you know, virtually all the films hadn't been distributed yet. And I got to handle the translation of all the films into various foreign languages, mainly English, of course, and but also French, Spanish, and German, mainly. Oh, and Chinese.
Yeah, and that's all there in the book. So many amazing anecdotes about not only brokering this relationship with Disney around both Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away, but also tackling the Chinese market as well. These big anecdotes. But I wonder, what was a normal day on the job for you?
There were no normal days. You know, a lot of traveling because I adhere to the traditional Japanese way of doing business, which is face to face. A lot of the things we were doing, I think. It's always better to do it in person than any other way. You know, and a lot of the film distributors we were talking to had not really heard of Ghibli films, and they had a low opinion of Japanese animation in general to begin with, you know. And so it was kind of an uphill battle. And in those days, when I first started, say Japanese TV animation was selling abroad for $50 an episode, you know. So when you're talking to distributors, you're talking to people who expect, you know, to pay very little for the rights and expect to have very few restrictions on what they do with the rights. So in that sense, it was kind of difficult. And the other part of it was, you know, finding the right distributors, which involved, you know, going to the places and talking to people. I think we were especially lucky in the UK. We found a really good distributor right off the bat, and Optimum Releasing. And they, I'm trying to remember where it was, but they were, when I first went, they were in a really tiny office on the second floor above a used bookstore. You know, now they're a huge distribution company, but they were just starting out. And they knew of Studio Ghibli's films, and they were very interested in, you know, seeing if they could do distribution. I think the best example is Spirited Away. Mm-hmm. Even though it was hugely famous everywhere in the world, hadn't really started to win awards yet, but it was, you know, it was incredibly, had a great reputation, but it was really hard to find distribution. And then we had the problem with Disney, of course, but
That's what's amazing. All of that is detailed so well in the book, and I mean I've been recommending it to everybody.
Oh, thanks.
Not only because it's one of the few books in English that go into detail about how these films were made and how they were released around the world, which has become such an area of interest for me and passion.
Oh, great.
As well as for this podcast, you know, really wanting to talk about how these films are sort of repackaged, if you know, or not, or you know, when they're re-released around territories. So that's why it's really fascinating that you've already brought up UK distribution, because that's something that you don't necessarily cover in detail in the book. But for a, how old would I have been, 15-year-old kid in Manchester in 2001, 2002, the fact that Optimum Releasing released Spirited Away, got proper posters with pull quotes from the likes of Jonathan Ross, the BBC's film critic.
Yeah.
It was shown at the Corner House, the local cinema, art house cinema that I could go to. It was a huge deal.
Right. I mean, you see, that's good, because that's what I mean. I mean, you don't find that out unless you go. You talk to these people. And yeah, they're in this little tiny office, you know, that looks like they're going to be out of business the next week or something, you know, and there's people just crammed in. But when you hear how they talk about how they're going to distribute it and what they think of the film and, you know, things like that, you realize you're talking to the right people. It may not look like it from the outside, but you realize, yeah, these are the people you want to be distributing this film. You know, we could have had somebody bigger and more mainstream, I guess you would say, but you know, we just felt these are the right guys.
And that is also part of the book. The book could also just be read from the point of view of the differences between Western and Japanese business practice, and how meetings are conducted and how offices are run. And that's really fascinating. I almost wonder how that face-to-face, trust-based system is working in the time of the pandemic, of the time of Zoom meetings, rather than actual meetings in the physical space.
Well, that's a good question. You know, it seems to me, although I don't know from actual experience, that it really hasn't changed that much. You know, for one thing, from what I hear, Japanese business practice is still continuing. I mean, the way people are behaving in Japan. They haven't changed much. They haven't made that many concessions to the coronavirus, you know?
Right.
And even when I lived in Japan, it wasn't unusual to see a lot of people in public wearing masks. So that's a thing that they're used to. They have, my wife was pointing out, you know, in the pollen season, you know, and people are worried about allergies, just about everybody's wearing masks. So it's not a, you know, it's not a leap for them to do that. And, but on the other hand, they didn't close bars or small restaurants. And I understood a lot of studios were, including Ghibli, a lot of businesses were still operating pretty much as normal. But they did, wherever possible, they went to video conferencing and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I was talking in the book about Mr. Tokuma, who... you know, was the president of the company that previously owned Studio Ghibli. And he used to invite me upstairs to eat ice cream with him, you know, and I never got that. You know, it's just a strange thing, I thought, at the time. But as I was telling Michael, you know, and somebody asked me about it in an interview, and it just suddenly clicked. He just wanted to look me in the eye and see if I could sit there and eat ice cream with him, you know, without getting nervous, because that's how he could tell whether I was up to anything that, you know, he wouldn't approve of. So, you know, he was an old school Japanese businessman, and that's how they, you know, they paid attention to that kind of thing. And and you're right, you don't get that so much, I guess, when you're doing Zoom conferences or just phone or email, whatever. It's important.
It's very hard to have ice cream breaks.
Yeah, but to get back to what I was originally saying, it was really important in the beginning, you know, to make sure people understood how important Studio Ghibli was, you know, what kind of a studio it was, and that, you know, without disrespect to other studios, it wasn't just, you know, typical anime. This was really serious filmmaking, and, you know. And I guess we're the biggest breakthrough. It became a lot easier once Spirited Away won the Golden Bear at the Berlin Film Festival, because it was the first animated film to ever win a major award at a major film festival. You know, and that kind of put a stamp of legitimacy you know, as as a film. I mean, that, you know, that's something that Miyazaki himself always felt, that, you know, we're filmmakers. We're not just making animation. This isn't cartoons. This isn't anime. And again, when a Japanese person uses the word anime, it's a different word than, you know, than we use it in English, let's say. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
when Miyazaki-san says anime, he just means animated filmmaking in general. You know, he's not referring to a specific style of filmmaking, say.
Which is where in the West, in the States, and in the UK, anime's become this sort of subgenre where it's almost serving a specific demographic with certain sorts of expectations and presumptions.
Right.
And I wonder, when doing this job, going and speaking face to face with all these distributors from various territories, what were the common misconceptions and presumptions you were facing and trying to overturn?
Well, let's start with the United States. In America, they believed that animation was only for children. It's not something adults or young adults should be watching, just for kids, cartoons. To begin with. Then there was the question of the length of a film. Since it's for kids, it can't be any more than 90 minutes. If a film is longer than 90 minutes, forget it. No one will ever come to see it. There was that. I guess into the parts that they talked less about is that it's Japanese. Americans don't like foreign films. And America, I guess I would say America's probably the only place that I'm familiar with where they don't ever dub anything. You know, nothing is dubbed. Whereas, gosh, in Japan, they dub everything and it's done so well. Not really familiar with the UK, but I know in France, they do an incredible job. You know, a lot of things you watch, you wouldn't know that it was ever originally in another language. Mm-hmm. But in America, they don't do it. So because they don't do it, there's nobody that does it well. So when they do it, they actually don't do it very well because they don't have the experience. And it costs a lot of money to do it. So.
Right, yes.
So, but that's a handicap. So when the first film we did was in the U.S. was Mononoke Hime. And Miramax at that time, they were starting to do really well with foreign films. They were getting into the mainstream. I think they'd just done The English Patient, you know, and they were starting to think, well, yeah, you know, these foreign films, they don't have to be limited. They can go mainstream and people will watch them if we can dub them. So they first dubbed Il Postino. Do you know that film?
Yes, yeah.
So I've never seen the dub, but from people who have seen it, I heard it was just hilarious. According to the people that I talked to, the only possible reaction was laughter, which is not the way they intended it. And I think they thought, okay, so that wasn't so good. Let's try an animated film. You know, that's why they were really anxious to try and do a really good job dubbing Mononoke Hime.
Right, yeah.
They hired Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, exactly. And that's told so well in the book. You said that you focused on the US there in terms of the presumptions you had to face.
Right, so it was the US. I guess in Europe, we heard a little bit less of that, let's say. Mm-hmm. But I think that was because we were talking to people who were more in line with what we wanted to do. The UK, I think the dubbing was pretty good in the UK when we did separate dubs. That was the UK and Australia preferred to have their own dubs, and I think we didn't want to spend the money, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. Apologies for that. But France, man, France and Japan, in a lot of ways, are just like they're right on the same wavelength in a lot of things. And France was the one market where we never had any problem. And I mean, to the extent that our best distributor in France was Disney, because the Disney people in France are just so different than, you know, the people there, the Disney people in other countries.
No, but it is crazy, isn't it? And anecdotally, you know, people I know who grew up in France or Italy or Spain just seem to have a more broader international appreciation of animation. They were seeing maybe some of even the pre-Ghibli series that Miyazaki or Takahata would be working on that have never been shown in the UK at all and are pretty hard to track down in English.
Yeah.
So just different culture and different appreciation of the filmmaking.
Well, I mean, that's... Yeah. Brings up another interesting point. I mean, a lot of the stuff, if they had been, it would be pirated stuff. It wouldn't be legitimate. And because of that, it's hard to get that stuff. And also from the point of view of budget, it's hard to get that stuff dubbed and dubbed properly. But, I mean, there are other technical problems with the earlier films. Kind of boring rights issues that prevent them sometimes from being legitimately licensed by companies that would do a good job. But, for example, in Italy, we had a lot of trouble. Thanks to the internet, we would find out after a film was released, we'd get all these complaints. This is wrong. This is wrong. We'd look into it. In Italy, for example, the first films that Disney released were so badly mistranslated, we couldn't believe it. You know, they even got Hayao Miyazaki's name wrong and all kinds of terrible. I can't remember anymore. It was just terrible. So we looked into it and we found out, they hired a translator whose entire experience was translating a couple of comic books and had 2 years of Japanese language in college. That was it. Mm-hmm. So it's easy enough around the world. It's easy enough to have something translated from English to whatever language. But from Japanese to that language, France is pretty much the only place where you can do it. So what we had to do is we had to make what we call a literal English translation that's not beautiful. It wouldn't fit the screen, to be used, but you could use it as a base to do a translation into another language. You know what I mean? So in other words, these scripts exist somewhere. There's a perfectly translated script in English that they would use as the basis to translate into other languages, and that's important, because the fact that it's in Japanese made it a problem to distribute, and then the fact that it was badly translated into Japanese kind of wrecked the movie in a lot of ways.
Right, yeah. So we recently interviewed a voice artist who contributed a voice to the film Tokyo Godfathers that was recently re-released in the States.
Right.
And she was telling us how in the booth they were given almost a grid of the literal Japanese translation, a sort of intermediate, and then a creative, and then a space for them to almost work within a space, which sounds
awful.
Like a crazy job to have. Yeah.
See, I think, I've actually done it just to see what it was like, but I can't imagine anything more difficult because you're trying to give a professional performance. You know, these guys are really great voice actors and voice actors, but you've got to match what you're saying to the lip movements on the screen, and they only do the lines a bit at a time usually. So you do it, you do like 7, 10, 20 times, and then you've got to go back. They listen to it, they pick one, and then they say, okay, now do the rest of the line. You've got to pick up the same intensity, the same whatever it was. And that and the first people to, the when the first people, each person that dubs listens to the lines before them. So the very first people are listening to in Japanese. Their lines are in Japanese. They don't really know exactly what's being said sometimes. That makes it's really hard to do. And, in my experience, the people who are really the best at it are British as it turns out.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Our British Patrick Stewart was amazing. Minnie Driver, Jean Simmons, she was absolutely great too. She was really wonderful.
Yeah. But then after all that work and sweat to go into the dub, this is a question that is the fanboy at heart. It's always been a question for me whenever I ask somebody who works in the industry, should we watch the dub or the sub?
Yeah.
Version of a film. And which do you think?
And the bad news is there's no real answer to that. I've heard a lot of different opinions, and I obviously can't have an opinion because I hear it in the original language, and mm-hmm. But I think I would say people have said to me what they do is they watch it in subtitled, and then they get it, and then they watch it again in the original language. So I guess that's it. But I think, my own personal conclusion is if you don't understand Japanese and you don't hear the original Japanese, you're going to lose something because especially both Miyazaki and Takahata, but especially Miyazaki, the language is so beautiful and so perfect that it just, it's a layer of the film that, so what we try to do is give you as much as we possibly can, given the limitations, when we dub it. Even if you the subtitled version, the thing about subtitling is if you're reading the subtitles, you're missing what's on the screen. And Hayao Miyazaki is incredibly visually oriented. So, I don't know if I told this story in the book, but one of the things I used to do was approve the color timing of the films released abroad. Mm-hmm. So for the U.S. releases, I would fly to Los Angeles and go to Technicolor, and we'd sit in screening room, mm-hmm. small screening room with a couple of guys, and we watched the entire film, brand new, perfect print. I mean, this is another thing I learned, too. In the days of film, a print, degenerates every time it's run through the projector. So if you've never seen one of these films in its pristine, perfect version, wow, you're really missing something. I mean, it's amazing. So I'd fly in, I'd be jet lagged, I'd sit in the room with these guys, we're watching the film that's double screen. One screen is the original, one screen is the new version. They're playing together, and I'm no sound, so you can talk. And, I'm watching these films, and these guys are going, so look what's happening in that corner, did you notice that? And I'm watching this stuff, and I realize, oh my, it's like watching fireworks, And these guys are saying, I can't believe they did that. Nobody would do that, There's so much going on here. Look at the detail, and you're watching this movie, and it's just incredible. It was just an incredible experience. And the one I think about the most is Porco Rosso, which, I'd only seen that on video, and I never really appreciated it until I saw it on the big screen and a pristine print. That is an amazing film, and I don't think you ever really get it unless you've seen it in the movie. Well, maybe home theaters these days, but if you've seen that in a movie theater, wow.
Well, we're experiencing that a little bit with even within my lifetime, or my lifetime as a fan of these films, going from the DVD release to the Blu-ray release.
Right.
That gives the film a whole new life. Very recently, I'd been carting around quite an old DVD of Princess Mononoke for the last three or four house moves I've had, and then very recently upgraded to Blu-ray, and it was like watching a whole new film.
Right.
So I guess I know what you mean. Your intention is split, reading the subtitles, watching the film, but really, if it just gives you more excuses to watch the film over and over again, then we're all happy, surely.
Well, that's the other thing. Miyazaki always said he didn't want people to watch his films more than once.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, you never.
Why did he say that?
You'd have to ask him. He said it a lot. He said, okay. People shouldn't watch it over and over. Well, he was opposed to video. but he was convinced of why he had to release it on video. But no, I mean, so as an artist, you know, this is how he sees the film on the big screen. In other words, he draws, he creates it for the big screen. That's how it's meant to be seen, if you know what I mean. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know if there's an example, but that's his vision of the film. So he doesn't like the idea of people looking at it on a smaller screen or pausing it or whatever. Do you know?
Yeah. No, I understand
that. Well, plus it's a theatrical experience. So, you know, you're in a dark and big, dark theater and there's a wonderful sound system. And there's other people in the room. You know, that's the experience he's creating the film for.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you know, that's not to say that the film is actually diminished by viewing it any other way, but that was his, you know, that's how he looks at it as the...
Exactly, and if you're a fan of these films as I am, seeing it in the cinema, in the theatre is a whole other experience. The fact that you can drink it all in and be completely surrounded by it. I know you say that home cinemas are getting better, but you haven't. No, I don't even have separate speakers for my TV.
Right.
So it's not competing with a cinema just yet.
No.
But I like how what is so invaluable about your book is that for the English language reader, it's giving us this insight into the dramatist personae behind these films.
Okay.
Miyazaki. Well, also, primarily the secret hero of our podcast all the way through is Toshio Suzuki.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Every time when we're setting the context for a film, he's the guy that is putting everything in place. He's almost the sports team manager who's just putting everybody in the right place, giving them the right encouragement, maybe using a bit of reverse psychology or some secret tricks to get the best out of the situation.
Absolutely.
And so I think that your book just illustrates that perfectly, I think.
Well, yeah, I'm actually, you know, as you were saying before, I'm surprised. I believe, you know, you could talk to Suzuki-san. He's usually, no?
No, well, I would love to. I think it's just that the opportunity hasn't arisen yet. Also, does he give English language interviews? I don't.
Well,
is he somebody who
he doesn't speak? Yeah, he might, but you probably would want to bring an interpreter. But I think Suzuki-san would probably talk to you. Maybe. I think so. It's harder to get. I mean, you know, Miyazaki. Obviously, he spends his time working. He doesn't do interviews. Until he's finished in that, you know, in that gap between finishing and thinking about the next one.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're encouraging me to go ahead and try.
Yeah, I would try talking to Suzuki. Because, no, but not that many people realize how important he is. And I think that's a good thing. Because as you say, he really is key.
And I love the sort of little details of his character you put in there, how he's a bit of a gadget fiend and has his car with all of his, is it sat navs or CD players and stuff attached to the dashboard before they were common in the cars themselves.
Right, because you know all the Japanese makers used to come to him with prototypes and stuff, you know, to have him try things out. So,
I'd like to spotlight a couple of other people from the, you know, from Ghibli that you maybe mention even in passing in the book.
Yeah.
And feel free to say that you didn't have anything to say about them or if you didn't work directly with them. But for example, Isao Takahata,
a common, you know, I get asked that a lot, you know, you don't say much about Takahata-san in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I've thought about that. I think the reason is that, I don't know how to say this. Takahata-san was unbelievably, was an intellectual and very, very thorough. So if he thought about something, he really, really, really thought about it. And so it's hard to write about, because if you're writing about Takahata-san, you're writing about a guy who's, you know, like this for a long time. You know what I mean? It's all inside. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, Miyazaki is funny, he says interesting things, he gets angry sometimes, you know, he tells jokes, he's unpredictable, you know. You can write about Miyazaki. But Takahata-san is a lot harder because it's all going on inside. But he, you know, when he takes on, when he would take on something, he would really, really think it through and through and through. And, you know, that I think that shows in his films. You know, it really, it makes, his films are a lot different because he wasn't, well, he wasn't an animator or an artist, but he was just, he was the director, you know. And that, I think, kind of colors the way, you know, the way he was, his, how he operated in the studio. But I guess they're just, you know, there's not much anecdotally I could really say about Takahata-san. I think that's a lot of the reason why I didn't write about it. And while I was at the studio, he did My Neighbors the Yamadas, and I think that was it. He was, you know, he was where he was. They were trying to get Kaguya Hime going for a long time. So I think that was really it.
No, but he is, you watch his films and his films contain whole worlds. Not in the, you can say that about Miyazaki as well, because they are huge imaginative worlds, but Takahata has this journalistic eye, attention to detail. He's a philosopher. They're all there. For my co-host, Jake, the real discovery of this, he knew, had seen bits of Spirited Away or Totoro, kind of, you know, he knew the imagery of those films, but it was discovering Takahata's films that was the real eye-opener for him.
Yeah.
And so we'll never pass up an opportunity to ask about him.
Yep.
But I understand that. Did you then have to work on Yamada's to sell that internationally? Or I don't know how that, what the timeline of that would be. Did it even, I know it has an American dub, doesn't it? And it did come out.
Yes. Yes.
Disc eventually.
Yep.
But I suppose a bit harder to sell.
Well, you know, part, depend, and again, when you're talking about selling, you, I guess you're talking about different situations, different countries. And I always seem to go to America to begin with, but a lot of, especially since we were dealing with Disney, a lot of what drives the initial interest, let's say, you know, in releasing the film is how well it did in Japan.
Right.
And Takahata's films are more intellectual in a lot of ways than Miyazaki's, and so they're, you know, they don't, they have a little bit less popular appeal when they come out in the theaters. But unfortunately, for this is about Mr. Tokuma, you know, who, again, he was the head of the former parent company. So after Mononoke Hime did so well and broke all these box office records, the theatrical situation in Japan is that Toho owns, used to own, all of the major chains of theaters in Japan. And if you weren't showing in Toho theaters during school vacation in the summer, you weren't, there was no way you could do huge box office numbers. You had to be, you know, that was an absolute necessity. So after the success of Mononoke Hime, Mr. Tokuma decided he was going to go to Toho and negotiate with them mano a mano with their chairman. And he said, look, you know, this is Studio Ghibli. We're the best, you know, you're going to give us a completely different deal than you give everybody else, or we'll never release another film in your studios again, you know?
Right.
And Toho goes, you know, no. So, you know, it was a standoff. And Suzuki, poor Suzuki-san, he was like pleading with Mr. Tokuma, don't do this. But he did do it. And so the Yamadas had to have its theatrical release in the second tier theaters. So it got an inferior time slot in inferior theaters and didn't do nearly as well as the other films, and which made it, you know, 10 times harder to, you know, to sell in the US. But we did a great job. The dub is great, I think. It's one of the best ones we've ever done.
Yeah, well, I think it definitely has its place within the canon, and it has its fans. It really does. We've spoken to critics, we've spoken to animators who think that the innovations behind that film are incredible.
Oh,
the
yeah.
art style,
yeah, yeah,
everything.
And there's a lot
the vision behind it.
Yeah, there's a lot of good technical stuff in there. But, you know, that thing about Takahata's films are that they're like a really good wine. They age really well. You know, mm-hmm. After a while, and you go back and you look at them, it's like, oh, wow. You know, it's sort of, I don't know if I saw that when I first saw it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's one where certainly when I was a teenager and I'd watch Pompoko or...
Pompoko's amazing.
Even... Pompoko was one of the films we showed at the British Museum with a packed cinema, with a panel afterwards talking about the history of the Tanuki in Japanese art. And it was so fascinating to dig into that. Plus also the modernization, the urbanization of suburban Tokyo and everything like that. Really fascinating stuff.
It's just absolutely iconic. And then Omoide Poroporo, which is a completely different kind of film about, you know, a young woman coming of age. Also just absolutely amazing. You know, it just totally, I mean, his films, those three films especially, totally encapsulate a certain era in Japan so perfectly. It's just amazing. But, you know, but then he has his other films. Which, I mean, My Neighbors the Yamadas does too. But he, you know, he has his other films that are just completely different, like Jelenko Chie and, you know, his early TV animation that he did, you know, which is, again, completely different. I mean, those are children's films. And a completely different thing.
Yeah, well,
and Grave of the
they're
Fireflies.
The films that we're hoping, those early ones are the ones we're hoping will finally make it to the UK at some point, because they haven't ever been. I mean, that's the tricky licensing, I'm sure.
Well, we subtitled them all. I mean, that was kind of a pleasure. Mm-hmm. We subtitled them, and we subtitled, I forget what it's called, the one about the canals. It's a documentary. Do you know that film?
Oh, I have seen that documentary. Yeah,
it's just
the one he made in the late 80s.
It's fantastic. It really is. I just loved. I mean, it was such a pleasure to subtitle that and watch it over and over.
Well, it's quite a long one, isn't it? As well, it's quite a commitment to watch that over and over.
Okay, so all his are long. Yeah, all his films are long. All his films are long. Too long sometimes, in a way.
No, I think that his films are absolutely wonderful and such an important part. In the West, it is a flaw that the cultural conversation shifts so hard in the direction of Miyazaki's films. They understand why, because they do play to a broader family audience as well, and they maybe have a bit more of a popular appeal, but that's what digging into the library of their films is. That's what's so important about digging into the library, is you find such treasures.
Right. I mean, that's they do that. You know, that's how they feel. They've done something and they've done that. They don't do it again. Mm-hmm. They do something different.
Well, one thing I would like to ask that is related to the book, because it's the cover, but you don't talk about it so much in the book, is your appearance in The Wind Rises as Castorp, the mysterious German man in the country retreat. So that must have come about after you'd finished your day job at Ghibli, or was that still when you were working there?
No, I think it was the year after I retired. You know, I was kind of surprised that they asked me to do that.
Do you know why they picked you, and what was it like then? After probably doing all these dubbing sessions, then having to stand up to the microphone yourself.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, well, you know, I was surprised. But when they told me I had to do it, they also told me I had to, you know, I was okay with doing my lines in Japanese, but I had to sing a song in German, which, I mean, I'm tone deaf, you know, really, seriously tone deaf. And they told Miyazaki that, and he didn't believe it. So, you know, he sent me the music. And, you know, I practiced like hell. And I think I must have been visiting Japan, you know, before they did the recording session. And we had a meeting with Hisaishi Joe, and he played the music, and they had me sing the song, you know, to see how it would go. It didn't go well. But it didn't go well for Hisaishi either, because I don't know if I can do this on it, but Miyazaki had this image of how he wanted to play, him to play the piano. So he was, he had him, I don't know if you can see me, but he had him, his arms outstretched and looking over his shoulder like this at me while playing the piano. And he said, I can't play the piano like that. You know, and they had this argument. Yes, you sure you can play the piano? Yeah, just try, you know, and he made him try. And he couldn't do it. So they had to get somebody else to come in and fake the piano playing so he could get, you know, get the idea of how it would look. But, you know, I mean, learning German, that was the hard part, learning German that I don't speak. And then there's this one line in Japanese, "Kono otoko ushishi garuteru," and that is a phrase I've never in my life heard anybody speak aloud. It's so complicated and archaic. It's really hard to say, and you know, and it took me forever to. I had to do a lot of takes on that, but. Mm-hmm. Basically, it was easy in the sense that his vision of the character was me. So all I had to do was be myself, you know, speak Japanese. At one point, he said, "You're speaking Japanese too well. Try and sound more like a gaijin," you know. And
that's right.
The music part was a total disaster. And they ended up having to, you know, digitally improve it.
Did they have to auto-tune you?
They did. They had to digitally improve it in post-production. Mm-hmm. So,
but that's something I love about it's there in The Wind Rises, but it's also in other Miyazaki films where he may be telling this epic story that's set in a historical period, but there is elements within it where he'll say, "Oh, this character, I'll base it on." You know, based on you.
Well,
the character bring you into voices.
So the character wasn't based on me. I can't remember his name now, but it's an actual character it's an actual person who was a spy, I think for Russia. He was Russian Polish, which is my ancestry, you know. And and he, I think Miyazaki just felt if I'd lived at that particular time, that would have been me. Sort of, but but it's based on this actual guy, and you know, such a perfect example of how Miyazaki thinks that you know, I think about this, you know, watching the movie one time. Here's the thing you would never get, I don't think, from watching the movie. The reason I had to sing the song was because I'm trying to think that whoever requested the song would know that if the character knew the song, it had just been released in Germany. So he would know that this guy has recently been to Germany. Aha! Uh-huh. If he knows this song, he's recently been to Germany. So that's information about, you know, what they're doing with their, he was an engineer, what they're doing with their planes. You know, they're basing their plane on the German design. That's information. Mm-hmm. Because he knew this song that was incredibly popular. And it was a song sung by a woman who was actually secretly Jewish, who worked for the Gestapo. I mean, worked for the Scout. She entertained Gestapo. Hitler liked her. She was a movie star. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember her name. But this is all real historical stuff, you know.
Right, yeah. And it's all in there.
It's in there. So well, it's in there, but, you'd have to really dig to ever, you know, find out. But that's the thing, you know. I mean, that's the thing about Miyazaki is you can dig because most of it, there's a lot more behind it. And you may not be aware of it up front, consciously, but it's there. And it creates the texture of the film. It's what makes it, you know, what it is.
And it gives you the rare privilege of being dubbed by Werner Herzog.
Well, as a matter of fact, I have to say, they asked me if I would do it. I said no, because I'm not a professional. It's, you know, it's mm-hmm. If I'm the character he wants for Japanese version, fine, but not the English version. I said no. I thought they should use Christoph, God, what's his name?
Oh, Christoph Waltz.
Yeah, I thought Christoph.
From Inglourious Basterds.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. I said, that's the guy. You want that guy to do it. But they didn't listen to me. But if I had still been in charge, that's what I would have done.
So they had to settle with one of the most
unique
voices in film.
Yeah, it's true.
Another part of the book that really stood out for me, it's only a passing, well, not maybe not a passing reference, but something that really interests me is that maybe because of the ways that we talk about animation and maybe pigeonhole Ghibli within animation,
right.
Is we often only talk about animators influencing animators. So it's Ghibli has an affinity with Pixar or Aardman. However, you mentioned when... the Berlin Film Festival is happening, that Miyazaki is excited to be going round the locations of Barry Lyndon, the Stanley Kubrick.
Yes, film, yes.
Which is not a film I would have thought...
Me neither.
...had any connection with it, with his visual imagination.
I'm with you there.
And I wondered, were there any other maybe films or references that we might be surprised to know that sparked or influenced Miyazaki?
Not really. I can't think of any. No, they're often asked which animated films influence them. And I think that's pretty well documented. But live action films, I don't know. But yeah, Barry Lyndon was one of their very, Suzuki and Miyazaki, their very favorite films. They love that film. And I absolutely can't help you. You'll have to ask.
No, that's perfect. You'll have to ask them. Fine.
I don't know either. I was surprised too. Well, I don't know. All I know is, I mean, to be honest, God, what's his name? Ryan O'Neill, is that the guy who is the leader?
Yeah.
See, for me, he ruins it for me because he's just so bad. He's so bad in that film. But somebody mentioned to me that, yeah, you know, because you're an English speaker, you can hear how bad he is, but foreigners don't pick that up. So you'd have to ask them, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. It really is one of the great bad Irish accents committed to film.
Yeah.
Although I don't know if this is a reference that means anything to you, but Leonard Rossiter, who is in the 1970s, was a big British sitcom actor. He plays in the early part of the film, the guy that he duels with in Barry Lyndon, and I think his performance is just brilliant. Barry Lyndon's probably my favorite Kubrick film, so that's why that.
Oh, well, so you know, you understand
me
better than I do.
it's a beautiful film.
Must be. Those guys love it.
So I don't want to take up too much more of your time. I suppose only a couple more very quick questions, really.
Sure.
Thing that jumps out on IMDb for me is that you're thanked in the credits for Toy Story 3.
Oh, that's nothing.
And is that really nothing?
No. Well, I mean, I occasionally gave him some advice on translating into Japanese, which, uh-huh. But I think that was just about they wanted to use Totoro as one of the characters, one of the toys. And I helped them get permission for that. That's all.
Was that a hard process to go through, or was it quite easy? Because Ghibli are known as being quite protective of their characters. That's them appearing in a mainstream American movie.
I mean, it's funny because really it shouldn't have been a problem because it was a favor for John Lasseter, which was that's no mm-hmm. problem at all. But somehow. There's a trick to getting Hayao Miyazaki to agree to anything. He somehow, whatever you ask him to do, that is the one thing he does not want to do. So you have to be, when you ask him something, you sort of have to think about how you're going to do it.
It's a big deal for fans when you spot that in the background.
The other thing, the reason it seemed like a big deal is because it was Disney and, mm-hmm. you know, they have a heavy participation of lawyers in anything they do, right? So the reason was they would send over these absolutely ridiculous contracts, you know, like, okay, we're using Totoro, so now we have permission to do anything we want with Totoro in every right. country in the world whenever we want to do it and not pay you anything. So I think the thanks was for my forbearance in telling him to go f*** themselves and working with them to, you know, to pare down their requests to something more reasonable. That would be what I think.
That's perfect.
Because, yeah. Well, you may not know, but I mean, Pixar originally was an independent studio and Disney was their distributor. So in a way, they were in the same position towards Disney as we were. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So in other words, everything that we experienced with Disney, they had experienced, only obviously on a much larger scale, you know, with a lot more money involved. But so Pixar people were really helpful to us as well. Mm-hmm. And it was a pleasure to do whatever I could to help them.
Yeah, that's terrific. So my final question really is, part of the ongoing goal of our podcast is to champion these films and recommend them to people who maybe haven't seen them before or haven't dug deeper past maybe the big hitters up top.
Yep.
We've mentioned a few of them in the course of our conversation already, but what's the one that you would recommend, the one film out of the whole bunch you'd recommend someone to go away and have their mind blown by?
Oh gosh, I hate to recommend just one, you know, that the official position at Studio Ghibli was each film is like their child and you can't favor one child over another. Mm-hmm. And they're all different. But I don't know, you know, probably if you ask me on another day, I'd give you another answer. But I think today I would say Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind. But partly it's because I'm influenced by how difficult it was for them to make that film. You know, it was the circumstances of the studio at the time and, you know, the fact that it was really the very first feature-length animated film to be made and, you know, shown in theaters. And that was no easy accomplishment. And, you know, I think that film really, God, that really holds up so well today. It's a wonderful film. And I suppose it's not talked about as much as a lot of the other ones are. In fact, some people write about it like it's not a Ghibli film. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, technically, the studio hadn't, you know what I mean? It's the same people. They just hadn't mm-hmm. formed the studio yet. That's the film I would pick.
It is a great film, and I'm finally getting around to reading the manga. There's a beautiful 2-volume hardback edition that I've picked up, and that's of course goes into much more. The story keeps going and going beyond the boundaries.
Yeah,
of the
it's
film.
7 volumes, I think, altogether. They're originally yeah. set. Yeah, he spent a long time doing that. mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, Steve, thank you so much for spending time talking to me. It's been such an honor and a privilege.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Thank you so much to Steve Alpert there for joining us to talk about all his amazing experiences when working at Studio Ghibli.
And thank you to Michael Palmer from Stonebridge Press, who helped us put that interview together during very weird times for all of us. I'd like to just make one last plug for the book. It's so good for the Ghibli fan in your life, a perfect stocking filler, particularly if they're on the nerdy side. It's available wherever you get your books. I actually have it both digitally and a paperback copy because I'm that nerd. I only want to annotate things digitally. I want a clean paper copy.
I think that shows a lot of the difference between you and I, Michael, that all of my books are riddled with different tabs and folded pages and underlines. So we've still got two more episodes of this Whispers from the Heart series to come. Up next, we're going to be talking to someone who, Michael, you and I didn't know that much about, but Steph, you are very excited about this one.
Yeah, super excited. So next week we're talking to Rebecca Sugar, who created the highly popular, much loved show Steven Universe, a Cartoon Network series that's been running for a really long time now, and it's kind of just about come to its end. So really, really exciting to talk to her about that. And there's so many kind of anime influences in there, from the kind of conception of the show to just kind of bits and pieces being referenced here and there. And yeah, as you'll hear next week, when we spoke to Rebecca, there was a lot of love for anime and Ghibli and everything in between. So yeah, hopefully you'll join us next week for that.
I really can't wait to hear this chat, because yeah, I know next to nothing about Steven Universe. I've missed out on all this good animation. I didn't know there was such a connection with Ghibli. But until we release that chat, you can follow us on Twitter at GhibliAttack. You can send us an email at ghibli@little.studios.com.
And you can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael J. Leader.
You can follow Steph on Twitter at _StephWatts.
And you can follow Jake at Jake H. Cunningham. Ghibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. Our music is made by Anthony Ng, our artwork is by Sophie Moe, and Jamie Masner is our audio wizard. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Steph Watts, and Harold McShiel.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders that we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.